This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Earthwise, Environment and Peace with Justice interviews on Plains FM 96.9.
Welcome to Earthwise. I'm Lois Griffiths. For today's program, we will begin by repeating an October 2020 interview we did with New Zealand journalist Nikki Hogger about the Australian journalist Julian Assange and about WikiLeaks. It's a chance to catch up to date on the story so far. But at the end of this repeated interview, we'll bring the story of Julian Assange up to date.
Well, Nikki is one of two New Zealand members of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. I don't know who the other one is. Nikki, who is the other one?
The other one is a great guy called Matt Nippert, who does financial reporting for the New Zealand Herald.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Today we'll be discussing the disturbing treatment of Australian journalist Julian Assange, and also the disturbing neglect of the treatment of Assange by our own New Zealand mainstream media. Welcome to Earthwise, Nikki Hogger.
Hello, good to be with you.
Well, Nikki, you were able to testify on Julian Assange's behalf. In fact, you've worked with WikiLeaks and you've met Julian. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I was very pleased to be able to be part of the court case. It felt like it was a piece of world history unfolding at the time.
Well, certainly it is, and I hope I fear what's coming afterwards if things don't turn out the way we'd like to. What were you working with WikiLeaks, or what was your connection?
I had contact with WikiLeaks actually from when Julian Assange first had the idea about 2006.
Ah.
And he'd made contact with me at the time, and so I'd been watching it growing and the way it went over just a few years. From an obscure idea of a guy in Australia who thought he could do something about the growing secrecy in the world and the awful war on terror wars that were going on, and watched it grow from that into the history changing thing which it's been. But I particularly became involved at the time of the big leaks about 10 years ago. And that was when WikiLeaks got leaked by Chelsea Manning, the U.S. intelligence officer. First of all, the Afghanistan and Iraq war reports, which are an amazing resource of document, and then the U.S. embassy cables, which had been on the same database in Kuwait where Chelsea Manning was working. And when they were releasing the U.S. embassy cables, I got a call out of the blue when I was just sitting working one day saying, "Hello, do you know who I am?" And luckily, I guessed that it was this deep voice was Julian's. Could I come across to Britain because there's something important happening? And I said, I don't normally just fly to Britain in the middle of a week. Is it really important? And he said, it's really important. And so I left a day or two later and went out into the countryside where WikiLeaks and him were sort of hiding at that stage, getting ready to release this huge body of U.S. embassy cables about all the countries of the world, and spent several days at their kind of hideout in this big old manor house, this crazy sort of Rocky Horror Show kind of a place, and helped process and write stories about the embassy cables which affected New Zealand. So that's and got to spend time with WikiLeaks, the staff, and with Julian face-to-face for the first time.
Right from the very beginning, really. It's just amazing.
What an amazing life you've led.
Well, it was pretty. It was a very rich time. I was very lucky to be there.
Could you just explain, in case people are still a little bit confused, of what's really going on? What actually did WikiLeaks do? What was their purpose?
WikiLeaks was Julian's inspiration. He was looking around the world. People will have forgotten this now, but early after the September 11 attacks, things in the West, and particularly in the United States, changed really fast. The United States had been a world leader of free information. You could go onto the websites of the Pentagon and places and get all this information out. And then after September 11, everything became very cold and secrecy was being imposed everywhere. Lots of government websites were closed down in the United States, so you couldn't get the information anymore. And so we were heading into an era where freedom of information and openness, transparency, were disappearing at a very fast rate at the same time as these ugly wars were going on. And Julian's inspiration was, he thought, okay, how can we do something which is like big enough to make a difference to this? And his idea was that if in the age of digital data, that someone with a memory stick could leak on a scale which had never been done before. People inside the system could bring out information as electronic leaks, which could then be put out to the world and sort of redress some of the growing secrecy that was going on around those wars and things.
So he was, would you say he was idealistic then?
Oh, he's incredibly idealistic, and he's not getting credit for this at the moment, but the inspiration of what he did there, I think when I see Edward Snowden doing what Edward Snowden did, I don't think that would have happened without WikiLeaks, the role model of these great big leaks which can change the world by making things which have been kept secret, unsecret. I believe most likely the Panama Papers and other big leaks like that, which have been really important in their fields, were indirectly inspired by, role modeled by the stuff that Julian and WikiLeaks did. So I think they've really had a profound effect on our era.
So he's already got a heritage, whatever happens to now in the future.
After that, as long as he survives as a person, he's going to live on as a very important person for the rest of his life, yeah.
We read a long time ago his unauthorized autobiography that was told about being a small boy and with his mother and really thinking that it was possible to change the world.
That's how I see him. When somebody is demonized for what they've done, which is what happens when the powerful are very angry at you, it's easy for people who don't know someone to just see that he's a horrible, narcissistic, difficult person. That's the characterization which has been put around about Julian. I see him as this basically idealistic, wants to make a difference in the world person, like everyone should be.
In fact,
you see, he's been demonized so much and smeared with all sorts of lies and...
It's an old tactic to shoot the messenger, isn't it?
It's to shoot the messenger, but it's even more than that. What we're all used to seeing is these tactics on a more terrible scale, which is where, someone like Gaddafi in Libya is a friend of the West for years, and then he goes out of favor, and before the bombing starts, there's always a demonization comes first of what a terrible person he was. And we're all supposed to forget that he was a friend of the West up until that moment. And then the demonization happens, and then the attacks happen. And it seems like it's the same as what's happened with Julian. He went from being a heroic figure to, for many people, including people who should have known him better, to being demonized. And then at the moment where he most needed people on his side sticking up for him, he had his least support because a lot of people were thinking, I'm not too sure about this guy. He's obviously pretty dodgy. And so he didn't have as much support as he should have.
But the way he's been treated, I mean, the ire of the powerful, who is out to get him, really?
The anger that he has generated and the wish for retaliation is totally understandable. And the reason it's understandable is he has been, with WikiLeaks, incredibly effective. And the example, which, as I say, I believe led on to Snowden and all those other things, that's a very powerful thing going on. So in some people's minds in Washington, D.C. and so on, sort of snuffing him out and smearing his name is a very important objective.
You were able to testify by video. We've read, not very many people have been telling the story, have they? We've read reports from Craig Murray. Is that the right name? From Craig Murray.
Craig Murray, yes.
And we've seen interviews with John Pilger. So the people we have tremendous respect are standing up for Julian, but I don't understand why our media is sort of ignoring it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got a small excuse in New Zealand that we've got an election campaign and COVID and other things going on. But yes, all around the world, maybe it's a short attention span in the media, but I think that the battle going on in court over Julian Assange at the moment is really tremendously big world news. That Julian is not one of many such cases of, you know, leaks and criminal charges and things. He's like, this is a leading piece of history at the moment, I believe, which is why lots of people, including me, have rallied to support him in the court case and around the court case now. Finally, after those years I talked about where he'd been demonized and didn't have the support he needed, there's really been a lot of rallying of people trying to help him in the last year. And the reason for that is that what happens to him deeply affects all of us. It does it, first of all, because if someone can do something profoundly good, which is what those leaks were, and they've done a lot of good in the world for human rights and other values, if he can be done for that, that's terrible for all of us. But also, if he can be done for the so-called crime of helping a whistleblower release information of the highest public interest, well, then everyone else, including me, who encourages people to release information in the public interest and to be whistleblowers, is imperiled as well, deeply imperiled, actually. And so this really matters, this case.
Well, he's not only being demonized,
Pardon, sorry?
He's being treated in a way that sounds sort of medieval.
I think, yes. Unfortunately, that the public isn't seeing this playing out day by day, issue by issue. But it's quite an astonishing court case because it's as if normal rhyme and reason is getting lost in it. I would have thought that the case would be thrown out multiple times. I would have actually thought that they would never even take the case because it's so weak. And yet it's more, because of the reality of power, which is that the US government is bent on getting him, you know, punishing him, that a essentially unfound case is grinding its way through the British legal system anyway. Having said that, I don't think the outcome is a foregone conclusion. It would be easy to say he's obviously going to lose, everything's stacked against him.
But especially, the judge herself seems to be totally biased. How can a court run if the judge herself is completely biased like that?
I had the same feeling. If I can give a different point of view on that, though, I was talking to one of the reporters who was in the Old Bailey during it. This morning I was talking to him, and he said, no, as the case went on, he felt more and more that the judge was maybe conservative, but acting in a way which is fair, because it's not, you know, the case being put by the U.S. prosecutors is really shaky. It's remarkable that their case is so shaky and so lacking in credibility. And so, luckily, either in this case or the one that will follow it in the higher court, and then if it needs to, going up to the Supreme Court of Britain, it's not a foregone conclusion yet, because the law courts are still relatively independent, and if the case is weak enough, well, then there's still a good chance.
And yet the way he's being treated and being described by Niels Meltzer, the reportateur for torture, that it is a kind of torture, as if they wanted to commit suicide. Do you get that impression?
Yes, I don't know about the wanting to commit suicide, but they have treated... this is, again, where we've been let down by the news coverage. He has been treated in an exceptionally bad way, not just in a normally bad way. It's quite astonishing what happens when very powerful forces from the United States are defining someone as the enemy. Yes, it's. I really like that Nils Meltzer stuff. It's someone in a high up UN position who's been willing to speak up very clearly about how badly Julian's being taught as an independent person. In fact, if anyone's listening to this and wants to read anything, I would read Niels Meltzer, because it really brings home to you when he says, he writes these beautiful words about how, for a long time, I didn't realize how bad this was until I looked at myself, and this is really bad. This is like as bad as it gets, basically, in the treatment of a person who's within supposedly sound and just legal system.
You're listening to Earthwise, broadcasting in Christchurch on Plains FM 96.9, in Hamilton on Free FM, and in Waikanae on Coast Access FM. Today's guest is New Zealand investigative journalist Nikki Hager.
Well, Nikki, we're very fortunate at Plains FM to talk to you. Have you been interviewed by the New Zealand mainstream media?
No.
That's shocking. And what about say, Australian media?
No.
Any media at all, apart from us.
You're in the very honoured position of being the only people who have contacted me about me appearing in the Julian Assange court case in the Old Bailey in London.
Honestly.
Which I must confess, I was surprised that nobody contacted me about it.
It is shocking. I'm quite disturbed about the state of journalism in New Zealand. I know that journalists, I'm really aware of the international ones, like John Pilger and so on, are frightened about the precedent that's been set if Julian is sent to Washington and put on trial there. How do you see the future for journalism? What sort of precedent is in danger of being set?
Yes, I can explain this, yes. A few years ago, when there was the Obama presidency in the US, they looked at whether they would try to extradite Julian Assange and convict him in the United States. And what the US Justice Department decided at that time was that if they were going to bring Julian Assange to court for the Afghanistan information, the Iraq information, those U.S. embassy cables, which is what this is all about, those big leaks 10 years ago, then if they were going to charge him, they had to charge the New York Times, because the New York Times was part of exactly the same process of getting the data and writing stories off it and so on. And so they realized, this is just impossible, because our country and our constitution doesn't allow us to start, you know, using espionage charges against the New York Times, as they're using against Julian Assange. And so they dropped the whole thing. And now the Trump government restarted it all and now have him in court. And that's what's at stake in this. It is that it's not just about Julian Assange. This is why the precedent is so chilling. It is that it might be me next. It might be somebody in the U.S. It might be someone in the developing country who gets important information which the powerful do not want to be released, and where they want to use the same approach of maximum punishment of the people who are involved in obtaining and publicizing the whistleblowers. And so this is kind of goes to the heart of the work of people, of me and my colleagues around the world, because what we do all the time, what we go to conferences to learn how to do and advise each other on and cooperate on, you know, our core business, which is going out and finding people in positions of authority who will tell the public things which otherwise they're not going to hear, which they need to know to be part of a democratic society and to stop abuses of human rights and whatever it is. That very thing that we do is the thing which they're criminalizing now by saying that Julian Assange should go to prison for 175 years. For what he's done. That's exactly what the rest of us do. So it's a very important principle that's being fought over now.
I think Julian Assange has said to a journalist, we're all on trial. This, it's scary. It's sort of trying to stop foreign journalists anywhere in the world from criticizing the U.S. It's also stopping the public like us who want to know what's going on. We want to be able to access information ourselves. And I'm afraid our time is up, Nikki. It's a privilege to talk to you, and we have so much respect for you. And so much respect for the the profession of journalism.
Nikki, could you just answer one question before you go? If this judge finds against Julian, what's the next stage?
If this judge finds against Julian, which is completely uncertain at the moment, or however she judges, whichever way she goes, it is everyone assumes that that will be taken up to the higher court, and then whatever way it goes there, it will go up to the highest court in Britain. So it's going to play out over many months to come yet, because it's such an important case. Whoever loses at this stage will be taking it to appeal.
And yet, meanwhile, he's in solitary confinement in these awful conditions.
Meanwhile, he is in the most inhuman conditions, and anybody who cares about him feels sick about what he's going through. Yes.
That's just a terrible, shocking story.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Nikki, for talking to us. And
it's always good to be with you. Thank you.
Good to hear what Nikki Hugger had to say. But remember, we've just listened to an October 2020 interview. But now, April 2022, 1.5 years later, Julian Assange is still behind bars in Belmarsh High Security Prison under appalling conditions. And most alarming, in March, the UK Supreme Court refused to grant Julian permission to appeal against his extradition. Well, I feel it's shocking. I find it so shocking the way so much of mainstream media refuses to even acknowledge Julian's existence, even ignoring Julian's wedding. Yes, Julian Assange and Stella Morris were married on the 23rd of March inside Belmarsh Prison. The whole event was tightly controlled. Only a handful of guests were permitted. Photographers were banned. After the ceremony was over, Stella was greeted by friends and supporters who'd had to wait outside. As Stella Morris said, these are her words, "I am convinced that they fear that people will see Julian as a human being, not a name, but a person. Their fear reveals that they want Julian to remain invisible to the public at all costs, even on his wedding day, and especially on his wedding day." End of quote. Now, Julian's father, John Shipton, was allowed to attend. And when he returned to Australia, this is what he had to say. Quote, "Dear friends, I have just returned from London, where I witnessed Stella and Julian somehow transcend the nightmarish conditions of HMP Belmarsh to celebrate their love for one another and our love for them. Time is running out for Julian. His physical condition is shocking. Years of psychological torture and arbitrary detention demand their bitter toll. He has been denied his final appeal and is now awaiting a U.S. extradition order expected to be handed down on the 20th of April. If Julian had been subjected to a fraction of such treatment in an Iranian, Syrian, Chinese, or Russian prison, our own government," and he's talking as an Australian, "our own government would be publicly condemning such regimes as barbaric, immoral, and corrupt. Instead, our government remains complicit in silence to the wretched persecution of Australian citizen Julian Assange." Quote, those were the words of Julian's father. And it seems to me that our own New Zealand government also has been complicit in silence. Some of us here in New Zealand pleaded in vain with our government to offer him and his wife and their two young sons to offer them asylum. These are unsettling times. So, with that in mind, from us at Earthwise, goodbye.